Welcome or welcome back to Whores for Whore. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week we're discussing the murder of Natalie Holloway. Have you ever heard of it?
I don't think so. I think the only reason I know the name is because I saw it on the drafts.
Yeah. Okay. For the podcast. Yeah. Well, I didn't know because it's been, like, in the news a little bit recently because there's been some movement, but, well, actually, there's been a lot of movement, so. Okay, let's just get into it, and then you'll see.
Well, here's a spoiler. I don't watch the news.
Oh, well, I do.
It depends on the day that I'm having, on whether or not I have any kind of insight to the world, but, yeah.
That makes sense.
Mostly, I don't.
It was Monday, May 30th, 2005, and Beth Holloway was returning to her home in Birmingham, Alabama.
Alabama.
Following a girls' weekend in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Ooh.
Beth and her two closest friends had just spent the last 3 days sunbathing, relaxing, and spending time away from their teenage children.
Good.
You see, Beth's daughter, Natalie, had just graduated from Mountain Brook High School and was on her senior trip to the Caribbean island of Aruba.
Did you ever go on a senior trip?
Yeah, and it was to, like, the next big town over. And we did, like,
a, I never went.
We did, like, a lock-in at, like, a bowling alley. It was really lame.
Yeah. Okay, but you're from a really small town.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Yeah. We had one, but I didn't get to go because it was, like, I think it was, like, a couple $1,000s to go. And this was back in freaking 2011.
A couple thousand? No.
Because they decided to go to, like, Europe or something.
That would be really cool. But we did, like, fundraising. We had to fundraise for all of our stuff.
See, that would be great, but they never offered us, like, that was never an option.
That's stupid. So it should be fundraising, yeah, like always.
It was, like, a last minute, like, hey, and I think it was the year before, or, like, maybe the beginning of the year or something, but they were, like, hey, this is where we're going for the senior trip, and this is how much it's going to cost, and we need your answer and your money by, like, I think they gave us, like, a month to get it.
Are you from a small town?
Like a small city? No, honestly, like, it would be probably the equivalent of St. Louis, honestly.
Yeah, people don't have that kind of money just floating around in St. Louis.
I agree.
Yeah, anyway, I just thought it was crazy that she went to freaking Aruba, and I went to Springfield, Missouri. Oh, ever heard of it? Probably not. No.
Well, you know, never mind. I thought Springfield was going to be bigger.
No, it's small. It's very small. But that, growing up, that was, like, the city.
Yeah.
So, that tells you where I'm from. Anyway, Natalie was a straight-A student who would be heading to the University of Alabama on a full scholarship in the fall.
Dang.
Yeah, and University of Alabama, isn't that the Roll Tide school?
Probably, yeah.
I'm sure I've told you this before, but Steven and I almost moved to Alabama for a job that he was interviewing for down there. And we went to a Piggly Wiggly, which is like it's a grocery yeah. store. Oh, yeah, in the one. South.
Yeah.
And we were just walking through the Piggly Wiggly looking for Yingling, surprisingly. And we were like, la-da-da-da-da. And all of a sudden, this girl in an Alabama shirt walks by. And the dude behind us goes, Roll Tide! So it's like definitely a thing. And I thought it was just something that was like funny. But no, it's an actual slogan they say to each other in passing.
No, I know. And my, where I grew up is actually close enough. It's literally on the border of Alabama.
Oh, like, yeah.
So it's close enough. So I grew up and that was like a football thing. Like, that's just what you said.
Roll Tide.
And then it was that. And then whatever the University of Tennessee is, like, what are they?
I don't know.
I don't remember. I don't care.
The only one I can think of now is TCU, and they're the Horned Frogs.
Yeah, they would feud on their sayings.
Oh, really?
Like, someone would say Roll Tide, someone else would say Go Gators, and someone else would say something from Tennessee.
That's
funny.
And I
don't remember what it was. But yeah, so coming away from the South, or like moving away from the South, and people saying it because they're like, oh, that's funny. I'm like, how is that funny?
You're like, that's a real thing that people say.
I didn't know that people didn't know it was real.
Yeah.
And that people took it so seriously. I was like, ew, why would you sit? Do you like sports? And they're like, nah.
Yeah. But also, okay. I'm just like, yeah, the South, they need some professional sports. Like, come on. Get them some professional teams, not just these. But I guess college football is, like, a really big deal. So, who do I know? Yeah.
Huge, yeah. Oh, it's Go Vols. It's the Tennessee Vols. V-O-L-S.
V-O-L. That's...
Volunteers is what it's short for.
Oh, Tennessee Vol. Okay, that is a lame-ass mascot. I'm sorry. Uh-huh. What the hell?
Yeah, because we're the volunteer state.
No, Tennessee. Oh, honey.
There's you some Tennessee history. You want to know what the colors are?
Orange and white.
Yeah, checkered orange and white.
Oh, so specific.
Anyway.
According to Beth, Natalie's mom, Natalie was a typical American teenager and a fixture on the Mountain Brook High's dance team. Beth insisted that Natalie never drank, never had a boyfriend, never had sex, but admitted that she was a little naive at times. Which, like, honey...
Well, at least you're self-aware.
Yeah. Which is kind of why Beth was surprised when at 11 a.m., Jody Behrman, who was one of the seven adults who had escorted the 124 students to Aruba, called and said that Natalie had not appeared in the hotel lobby for their return flight home.
Okay, so this girl literally went on her senior trip and never came back, basically?
Yeah.
Oof.
And in fact...
Nightmare.
No one had seen Natalie since the night before. So any other mother may have thought, you know, that Natalie or that their child was probably still out partying, passed out in a hotel room, but not Beth.
At 11 a.m.? Who's partying at 11 a.m.?
No, they're coming back. I bet those bars are open till like 5 a.m. in Aruba. They don't have no rules down there. Especially when they're catering tourism.
That's wild. That's too much.
Beth said, quote, I knew immediately that my daughter had been kidnapped in Aruba. Natalie has never been late in her life. End quote.
That's so specific.
And this is the story of the murder of Natalie Holloway. So, sad news. I gave it away already.
Yeah.
So, Natalie Holloway was born October 21st, 1986. So, she's 10 years older than me. She'd be 37. To her parents, Dave and Beth Holloway, obviously. Her parents divorced in 1993, and she and her younger brother, Matthew, were raised by Beth.
1993 was a large blizzard, I'm told.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Why? Is that the year you were born?
No, I was born in 92.
Oh, my God.
And then, yeah, the winter of 93, my parents have always mentioned the, quote, blizzard of 93.
That's cute. I love that. Also, Steven was born in 91, and I always think about how old Steven is. And then when I think about you, I'm like, Kayla's my age. I mean, you are my age. You're not old. Neither is Steven by any means. But I'm just like, 91. Oh, wait.
I didn't know he was born in 91.
Yeah, 91. He's old. Man.
Yeah. Jake was 94. And I'm like...
You're a baby.
Nah, you're my age.
Yeah. Oh, in 2000, though, Beth married a man named George who goes by Jug Twitty. So I'm going to call him Jug.
Jug.
He was a prominent businessman, and that's when the family actually moved to Mountain Brook, Alabama, which is basically a suburb of Birmingham. Which Birmingham is so cute. I loved Alabama.
Is it?
Yes, I loved Alabama when we were there. I was kind of sad that he didn't get that job, but that's okay.
I was very happy that you decided to move back to
Missouri. Not go to this deep, deep south.
Yeah. I think Alabama would be pretty to live in, but when you were like, oh, there's a job opportunity in Missouri, I was like, girl, take it. And I was just like joking. You're like, no, we are. I was like,
we're doing it. Yeah. They haven't said anything. We're taking it.
Yeah.
So Natalie was a tiny girl. Well, she was described as a tiny girl with long blonde hair who had an exuberant personality, but was also serious and idealistic. Mm-hmm. Again, she'd earned a full ride scholarship to college and had planned on enrolling in a pre-med track with the hopes of eventually becoming a doctor. Her friends described her as someone who was extremely smart and not a rule bender, which, like, I can relate to the not bending the rules.
Yeah, she's not bending the rules because she's breaking
them
in secret.
For example, one of her best friends named Claire later told Glamour magazine that, quote, Natalie turned 16 7 months before I did, and she got a cute little white Volvo. Even though I didn't have a license, I kept begging her, just let me drive it, please. And she finally said, okay, you can move it to one spot in the parking lot. She wasn't someone who liked to take risk, end quote.
I don't know. You can crash a car in a parking lot.
Oh, okay. Funny story. My friend Jessica, when I got my RAV4, she was like, yeah, I want to get an SUV too. And I was like, okay, you can drive it if you want. And so we met in the parking lot where we worked. And she's like, okay, I'm going to drive your car to where my car is. And so we did like a little tiny drive. And this is what it felt like. It was like, don't wreck it. Oh, but Natalie was also a goofball. So in that same interview, Claire and their other friend named, I think it's Molly. I wrote Maylee, but it's probably Molly.
That's cute, though.
Maylee. Yeah, Maylee is cute, yeah. She remembered that the three girls all had funny nicknames for each other, and Natalie's was Hootie because allegedly everyone would call her Hootie Hoo Holloway.
What the fuck?
And so when they would call each other on the phone, Natalie would always answer, it's Hootie, in a high-pitched, silly voice. The two women also recalled that there was no beating around the bush with Hootie Hoo Holloway. Claire stated, quote, if she had an opinion, she would tell you. Once I asked her to get me a soda, and she looked at me like I'd asked her to run a mile. Like, are you kidding me? Get it yourself. End quote.
That's a good trait to have.
Beth Holloway later recounted that when the chaperone called her and said that Natalie, you know, hadn't come to the lobby to meet, she didn't panic. In her words, she was, quote, extremely focused. From her cell phone, she called 911, telling the dispatcher that her daughter had been kidnapped and that she was driving 110 miles an hour straight through Mississippi, and she was not going to stop for anything. Then she called her husband, Jug, and the FBI.
Good. Yes. Call the FBI.
She wasted no time on this. By the time she got home in Birmingham, a family friend already arranged for a private jet. So by 5 o'clock, the same day that she learned, Beth, Jug, and three lifelong friends were in the air on the way to Aruba. And they left one empty seat for the return trip, a seat for Natalie. The jet landed at Aruba's Queen Beatrix International Airport around 10 p.m. on Monday, May 30th.
Wait, when did she get the phone call?
On the same day. whenever she was driving, like early in the morning.
Okay. So literally same day she's in Aruba.
Yeah, so she's like doesn't mess, which I'm like, yeah, I hope that this would be me as a mom, like just like, yeah. I'm getting the fuck there, you know. So the group piled into two minivans driven by workers from Aruba's general aviation office and headed to the Holiday Inn Hotel where the students and chaperones had been staying. Once there, they met up with a teacher from Natalie's school named Paul Lilly. And Paul had no news of where Natalie's whereabouts had been, but from all indications, she had never returned to the hotel from the night before. Her passport and luggage all lay where she'd placed them in preparation for the, you know, flight home to Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Weird.
She'd last been seen around midnight at a bar and grill called Carlos and Charlie's, where some of her fellow students had noticed her talking with a tall Dutch teenager and were under the impression that she left with him.
Mm.
Really quick, Mountain Brook is kind of a small... it's like a small little suburb. So actually Jug's nephew Thomas had been on this senior trip too. And so the day before, Thomas had been playing poker with a young man and knew that his name was Jerron or something. So Beth took a hotel employee aside and described the person, Jerron, and said, you know, have you ever heard of this person? Do you know him? And she said that she knew exactly who he was. His name was Jerron Vandersloot, and the employee said, quote, he tends to prey upon young female tourists, end quote. Who is Jerron Vandersloot? Well, I'll tell you.
Tell me.
Jerron was actually born in the Netherlands to his parents, Paulus and Anita. When he was young, the family moved to Aruba, and Paul's father was actually an attorney in the process of becoming a judge. At this point, you may be asking, where the heck are the police? Do they know what happened?
Where the heck are the police?
Well, according to Natalie's best friends and some of the classmates, they had contacted an Aruban police officer stationed at the hotel and told him that their friend didn't come back, and the police officer allegedly took notes calmly on the clipboard and told the kids not to worry, that Natalie was probably sleeping off her hangover somewhere and that she would be back. So, as of right now in the story, the police are no fucking help.
Shocker. I am so surprised.
Me too. Color me shocked. So, after talking to this hotel worker, who again said that Jerron Vandersloot was basically a no good, terrible, horrible, bad person, Beth and her crew headed to Carlos and Charlie's, again, the bar where Natalie was last seen, to do some sleuthing.
I love it.
They passed out photos of Natalie, interrogated nightclub workers and patrons, but sadly they learned nothing new. So again, all of this is happening the same day that Natalie disappeared. This is like late into the evening. So it's like prime club time, you know, they probably weren't trying to talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
The group returned to the Holiday Inn, where Beth and Jug headed upstairs to the hotel's casino to find the manager. The manager offered to find a video of Natalie and Jerron in the casino together so they could know what he looked like. Meanwhile, two members of their, you know, search party that came from America went on a hunt to find someone who did know who Jerron was without actually knowing what he looked like.
So, why is the casino manager and, like, all these other people doing more work than the police officer? He could have easily walked up there and said, hey, do you have surveillance footage?
Yeah, right? That's, you know, question of the hour. So, in a stroke of luck, the two people from Beth's search party stumbled upon a group of teenagers drinking wine on the beach near the hotel. And one of the teenagers knew Jerron immediately and passed over his address. So they just told him where he lived.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah. So the group went straight to the Aruban police and told them that Jerron was the last person to see Natalie and that they wanted the police to speak with him. However, before you say anything...
did your job.
They did, actually, this time. For once in the story.
Yeah, but, like, someone still had to come up to him and be like, hey, did your job for you. Can you go, like, follow this lead that I totally pulled out of thin air?
Yeah, they basically handed them the whole case on a silver platter and said, if you could just speak to him, that'd be great.
I want to meet somebody that does that. Just goes up to somebody who it's fully their job and goes, if you could just do this, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. I don't know. Congress, maybe? No. But really, though, like, do your literally. Job. Sorry. Not to get political.
Yeah, for real.
Fortunately, the police were helpful in this one instance, and they agreed to send two uniformed officers with the family.
Good.
So, upon arrival to the Vandersloot's home, again, middle of the night, Paulus, Jerron's father, stepped outside. So, while the police were speaking to him, he makes a phone call, and they told him, you know, like, hey, we're looking for Jerron. The Paulus makes the phone call. And then he learns that Jerron was out gambling, which, like, that's a common theme in this story somehow.
Yeah.
And that he was down at the Wyndham Resorts Casino. So, apparently, the Wyndham was just, like, a short drive down the road, so they all went there, including Jerron's father, Paulus. However, Jerron was not there. Paulus made another phone call and informed them that actually his son was now back home.
Oh, weird. Funny. That's wild. Did you call your son? Did he tell you he was at the Wyndham? Why would he then go home?
Right? What was he doing? It's just, that's just like a weird hiccup that I also questioned.
Cover up.
But nonetheless, the whole group raced back home to Jerron's home, and they found Jerron and a friend named Deepak Kalopi, sorry if that is incorrect, I'm trying, waiting outside. Two police officers, as well as Jug, Natalie's stepfather, and two of his friends stood by as Jerron answered, you know, police questions. At first, they denied knowing Natalie, insisting they didn't even know the name Natalie. However, they all quickly caved, and Jerron said that he'd met her at the Holiday Inn Casino on Sunday afternoon.
That's sketch. No, I've never even met a Natalie.
Oh, I guess I did, actually. Oh, this blonde girl that's missing? Fun fact, I do know her now. So, Jerron told the police that Natalie asked him to join her at the Carlos and Charlie's nightclub, and he initially declined, saying, like, no, it's gonna be dead, it's a Sunday. However, a little before 11, Jerron called Deepak, who drove over with his younger brother Satish to get him, and all three went to the club to meet up with Natalie.
And why does it seem like Jerron's whole MO is just initial denial?
We hate him, so yeah, keep throwing shade. Jerron stated, quote, so I snuck out of my house and went over to see her. She came on to me, huge, dancing suggestively, like a slut. I did belly shots on her. On the bar. Eventually she said, could you take me home? So we left. End quote. Which, like, okay.
You probably drugged her and she probably actually wanted to go back to the hotel and you're too narcissistic to even understand what was going on. But sure, yeah.
Yeah, and even if she did come on to you, whatever. She's on her senior trip in Aruba. Like, a one-night stand is not crazy to think that she would be seeking that. Like, get over yourself.
She came on to me. Big. Shut up.
Yeah, shut up. Haven't you met a modern woman? God, get educated.
No, he hasn't.
Jerron claims that the three men drove Natalie straight to the Holiday Inn front door and that, quote, when she got out of the car, she stumbled and fell. I wanted to help her, but she got up and walked through the lobby. It was the last time I saw her, end quote.
Your Jerron impression is...
I hope I sound like an idiot, because that's him. So Geron was pressed for more information, and he revealed even more, stating, "We didn't go directly to the Holiday Inn. She wanted to drive around. That girl was crazy. She was just crazy."
Yeah, crazy.
I fucking hate this dude.
She's so crazy. She fell down and I really wanted to help her, but like it couldn't be me.
Yeah, I'm a really good guy. I wanted to help her. Like, I'm a good guy.
I'm such a nice person.
Oh, God.
Do you want to pop both of your collars too, Chad?
According to Duran, all four of them went to the lighthouse where Natalie gave him a blowjob in the backseat of the car while the two other men were outside of it. Which, like, whatever. Even if she did, like, okay, that doesn't make her, like, a slut. Like, fuck off, dude. Mm-hmm.
She totally showed me some kind of attention and I didn't want it, but, like, I never get that. Really, I'm the victim.
Yeah, you'll be surprised. So then, after Geron allegedly got a blowjob, everyone returned to the Holiday Inn. Geron pointed out that a security guard helped Natalie because he was unable to once she tripped and fell.
Okay.
So by this time, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, right? Because they're investigating all night. They've literally solved the case in, you know, the 6 hours they land, within 6 hours of landing.
Yeah.
But the policeman told Beth to wait at her hotel and that a detective would come by at 8 a.m. to speak with her.
Why 8 a.m.?
I don't know.
Aren't you guys, like, on call?
So tired.
Don't you have a night shift?
Yeah, seriously. Isn't your job to, like, help people? But anyway, these are Aruban police, so I don't know their, you know, history. Track record. That's
true. Yeah.
Not very good in this case, but anyway. So, Detective Dennis Jacobs arrived on Tuesday morning at 8:15, which already 15 minutes late, strike one.
Yeah, literally.
Took down Natalie's description and then led Beth to the police station.
What? She could have just been there.
Right?
She could have just gone to the police station. Like,
yep.
Hello?
And according to Beth, she sat in the lobby for 3 hours until Detective Jacobs spoke to her again.
I would have made a scene.
When he did come back, she rose, you know, eager to tell him more, answer any questions that he had. But suddenly Jacob said, "We won't be needing you." And just dismissed Beth. So.
But I wish you would.
And according to Beth, she stood there like stunned. Like, I cannot believe that this just fucking happened.
Elaborate.
Right? And so after a moment, she remembered walking outside to the first few television crews that would eventually arrive. Hundreds of television crews arrived.
Wait, why are they arriving already?
And that was the moment that Beth said, "I realized we were in serious trouble." So I think that they, like, that's when they called in the media because they knew that that would be the best way. Like, pressure.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, so after receiving minimal help from the police, Beth and, you know, the other members of the search party returned to the community members.
Wait, hold on. Go back just a second. He showed up late.
Yeah.
So she had to wait 3 hours for someone to show up. Showed up late. Took her back to the police station to have her sit for 3 hours to tell her, "We don't need you." I do not waste my time just to dismiss me immediately.
Right? And at least listen to her. Like, what can you lose? It's not like you're losing valuable searching time. You weren't even searching for her. So, like,
it just seems like a lot of, like, overseas cops don't really care, especially if it has to do with, like, a tourist.
And that's, like, understandable in a sense. Like, if your economy, okay, if the only thing you see are drunk American kids coming on spring break and senior trips, I get it. But, like, if a mom comes all the way down, not all the way down, but, like, if their parent comes from another country, like, at least listen to them. I'm not asking you to solve the case right there. I'm just asking to have, like, a little bit of empathy about what's going on. And also, like, there's some conspiracies that we'll talk about later, but, like, Aruba's economy is dependent on tourism, so you can't have, like, tourists dying left and right, which I'm like, yeah, that's not a good look, but you know what's also not a good look is not solving cases when people go missing.
Yeah, like, your best bet is to solve it and prove, like, who did it. And if it was this
Dutch
kid, like...
And say, this was a freak accident, but we did our due diligence. We captured the perpetrator in a timely manner. Like, don't be afraid to come here. We have great security, and we solved this. It was a fluke. Like, that's the story, but it's not. I should be a publicist, like a PR rep. Like,
you should. Like,
that's how you spin that shit. Just kidding. There's people way smarter than me about that. So, again, after receiving minimal help from the Aruban police, Beth turned to the community. She met a 37-year-old American-born editor of a daily magazine named Julia Renfro and another woman named Angela Musenhofer, she was American, and her family ran one of the island's most popular restaurants at the time. So she has a paper and a restaurant on her side. Apparently, according to Beth, when she walked into the paper's office to first tell them about her missing daughter, Julia and Angela remembered stopping the presses immediately, and on the front page, they decided to run a photograph of Natalie asking for more information. So these two women, who are best friends, were just like good chicks down to help. Angela later recalled that both her and Julia, you know, had children, so they could understand Beth's desperation. Angela stated, quote, "At the beginning, I was the one Beth trusted. She called me her angel. We were with them day and night. We weren't reporters. We were family. Beth told us that," end quote.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and especially if they're helping you, like, of course. So on Wednesday, Beth and Jug, which, again, Natalie disappeared on Monday. They got there Monday night. It's now Wednesday. Beth and Jug.
Jug.
Returned to the police station to, you know, provide their statements, tell them everything that they knew. And they recalled that Officer Jacob's behavior was extremely cavalier. Quote, "Wait, I haven't had my Frosted Flakes and I haven't shaved yet," he said to them.
What?
Yeah, allegedly. According to Beth and Jug, as they were trying to give their statement, he basically said, "I haven't had my breakfast. I'm not ready. Hold on."
Bro, you were eating Frosted Flakes at what age?
Yeah. And also, you're at work, so get to fucking work.
What do you mean?
Again, I'm not asking you to solve their case or anything, but I'm asking you to, like, you know. No, actually, I am asking you to solve their fucking case because that's your job. But also, like, have a little empathy. I'm not
asking you to do your job or anything, but because you do your job.
While Beth and Jug were at the police station attempting to talk to Detective Jacobs.
Doctor?
Angela and Julia met in the Holiday Inn's lobby to organize the first search teams. So, after a series of radio announcements, approximately 100 tourists showed up along with a smattering of Arubans and police officers. So, it was like a full-on, you know, search team, and Arubans, they, like, fucking showed up.
That's good. That's promising.
John Vander Straten, who was a police superintendent and ended up working the case, was not happy. Julia recalled that he, quote, "walks up to me and tells me, 'You can't do this.' I said, 'Yes, I can. I'm going to find this girl.' And he told me she wasn't even considered missing until 48 hours. In fact, he told me to go to ladies' night at Carlos and Charlie's and that she would probably show up there."
Oh, would she? Do you think so?
So you're just blaming her now. In that sense. Your
experience and, like, your gut tell you that?
Ugh.
There's ladies' night. She's probably there. Fuck off.
Seriously.
I don't know why that irritates me, but that irritates me.
Yeah, because it's like saying, like, well, she's probably, like, a party girl who's probably just hungover.
It's so patronizing.
Yeah.
It's just so patronizing.
And also, like,
oh, okay.
We've heard that story so much now. Like, next option, please.
Yes.
But sadly, at dusk, the searchers returned to the hotel, having found no sign of Natalie, and this terrible cycle would continue for the next 2 weeks. So for 2 weeks straight, they were searching for her. Ew, the balloons!
Yay, haunted! Okay, so... No, just keep going, it's fine.
And because the case was so high profile, there were so many tips and leads and sightings, which even led to a number of people being arrested.
Oh.
A tip came from a gardener at the Aruba Racquet Club who gave the police a sworn statement that he saw Jerron, Deepak, and Satish, who Natalie left the club with, near the club around 2:30 a.m. on the morning that Natalie went missing. He claimed he saw the three men digging at a vacant lot there. Luckily, the police did their job and they drained a pond near where the gardener said he'd seen them digging, but they found nothing in connection with Natalie, sadly. So eventually they did start taking it serious.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. But why would they drain the pond if he saw digging?
I don't know. Maybe the idea was that they, like, threw maybe, like, a tool in there, like, buried something and then threw something.
Yeah, they could also drain it and then use ground-penetrating radar, too, probably. Maybe that's it.
Maybe they thought that's where they disposed of the body and then they buried the weapon. I don't know. Seemed like a logical leap for them at the time.
True, true.
On Thursday, June 9th, 2005, Jerron, Deepak, and his brother were all arrested in connection with Natalie's disappearance, but after intense international pressure on the Aruban authorities. However, I would say that the arrest was warranted. Under questioning, Jerron changed his story multiple times.
I bet.
For instance, instead of leaving Natalie at the Holiday Inn, he now said that that Deepak and his brother dropped just him and Natalie off at the beach beside the Marriott, which was a half mile from the Holiday Inn. This area is sort of known as like a lover's lane. He said that Natalie was so drunk, she was dazing in and out of consciousness, and that he just left her there. Which is like a huge shift from where we were before.
Yeah, but also, you're such a nice guy.
Yeah, right? So, during weeks of questioning, the brothers were backing up his story, Deepak and Satish, each time he would change it.
Oh my gosh, are you serious?
Yeah, and by the end of June, with both Jerron and the brothers still in custody, everyone thought that charges like were coming and that the case was reaching, you know, its climax.
Yeah.
But on Friday, July 1st, a government spokesperson stated that they would not be pressing charges at this time and that the two brothers were being released. However, Jerron was to be held without charges for another 60 days. So basically they said, like, we don't have any information yet. We're going to release these two. But we think Jerron is sketch. Let's just keep him. Which, like, kind of questionable. Because, you know, you, like, can't detain someone without charges. But, like...
That's exactly what I was about to say. Like, how fucked is it that he's detained for 60 days? Like, that they can do that?
Yeah, that's... absurd. In this case, like, I love it because he's the bad guy, but also
I don't like the guy, but also, like,
he should still
fucked.
Yeah, that's not how
that's
we do
super
it
super fucked. Yeah,
but also again, he's horrible, so thank you.
he's a terrible person. Even if he didn't do it, he's still not a good person.
Yeah, dirtbag. Yeah,
just based on things that he said, like,
yeah, ugh. She's a slut. Yeah, he's horrible. So, despite multiple leads, tips, and the changing stories, Aruban authorities still didn't have enough to charge Jerron at the end of the 60 days, and he was released, and Natalie's case actually went cold.
Can you imagine just, like, yeah, just been on vacation for, like, 2 months?
And just, like, imagine her mom being like, yeah, I know who killed my daughter, but, like, due to, like, technicalities, we can't.
Yeah. But, like, did he do it or what?
That's what we're gonna get to.
God. Where's the evidence? Because he's a shit person, but, like, where's the evidence?
Jaron, after being released, decided to actually leave Aruba. He actually traveled back to the Netherlands again, where he was from. He enrolled in college. The Kalepos brothers returned to their jobs, and eventually Beth and Jug went back to Alabama. So, like, like, sadly, life had to continue in the worst way possible.
Yeah. And I can't imagine being then, too, like...
Yeah.
Your daughter is supposed to be away at college, but you have to, like, leave a different country without her. Like, how open-ended that is. Like, there's no closure at all.
Nothing. No closure. And you, like, your daughter was on her senior trip after graduating high school. It's, like, the start of her life. Yeah. And it's just over. Like, that's fucking insane.
Yeah. And, like, I know a lot of people, like, don't want to leave the last place they saw, like, you know, some loved one that is missing or whatever. So I'm surprised that they left.
Because, like, realistically, like, you would hope that, like, you hope that she is going to turn up in Aruba. Like, that she's somewhere on the island. But, yeah. It's just, yeah. I cannot imagine. Which is why I cannot have kids, because I would lock them in a closet.
Hello. Whoa. What's that? We gotta get this figured out.
I know. That was weird.
That's weird. I mean, hey, she's with us. She's telling us.
Disgustingly, Jaron seemed to revel in the newfound fame because, again, this was a very high-profile case. He agreed to do an interview with ABC News where he once again changed his story, now saying that he left her on the beach, publicly changed his story, now saying that he just left her on the beach the night she disappeared and went home.
Well, hope you slept great.
Yep. In 2008, a videotape emerged that showed Jaron describing Natalie's death. It was actually filmed via a hidden camera by a Dutch crime reporter named Peter de Vries. That might be the wrong
saying. Yeah, Peter.
In the tape, Jaron said that he'd been on the beach with Natalie and that the two had sex, but afterwards she began shaking and lost consciousness.
What?
No. So not his fault, but she died. Not his fault.
Dick was so good that she died.
He asked a friend to take her body out in a boat, like, to see and dispose of it, which allegedly his friend did, which... Jaron did not dispose of her body because he is such a good guy.
Yeah, such a good guy.
In 2010, Beth's family lawyer named John Q. Kelly claims that Jaron contacted him over email. Jaron allegedly told the lawyer that he wanted $25,000 up front because at this time there was a very large reward out for any information. I think it was like $100,000. And he wanted $25,000 up front and that he would reveal the location of Natalie's remains.
Well, he didn't, you know, quote, dump her, so how would he know?
Exactly. So Beth and John worked with the FBI, you know, basically to gather evidence against wire fraud and extortion at minimum. Like, if you can't pin the murder on him, pin him for anything else.
Do they have the email?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Allegedly, Jaron told John that he and Natalie went down to the beach where he picked Natalie up in the air, like, you know, like by her waist. And and that she told him to put her down, and when he did, she tripped and fell and hit her head on a rock and died.
I bet. Yeah.
And then Jaron panicked and called his father, who then took Natalie's body and hid her in their home's foundation.
I knew I didn't like that guy.
Which is, like, the first time he's implicated his father in the murder now. So, shortly after receiving this alleged confession, John, the lawyer, received an email from Jaron stating that the whole story was a lie and that none of it was true.
I'll bet that's the truth.
Yeah, right? In a very strange twist of fate, just days after attempting to extort Natalie's family, Jerron went to Peru. On May 30th, 2010, 5 years to the day of Natalie Holloway's disappearance, a woman named Stephanie Flores was found dead in a hotel room in Lima, Peru. Stephanie...
Wait, what year was this?
2010.
Okay.
So Stephanie was the daughter of a presidential candidate, so the case, like, you know, got a lot of media attention immediately. And so the hotel room was discovered to have been rented out by Jerron, who had already fled the country and crossed into Chile.
I'll bet.
Jerron was arrested very shortly after everything was discovered, and he was returned to Lima, where he eventually admitted to killing and robbing Stephanie. In 2012, he pled guilty and was given 28 years behind bars.
Good.
But, remember that extortion, U.S. prosecutors actually announced that they were going to bring charges against Jerron for this.
Good. Good.
They were not going to extradite Jerron until his, until he had served his sentence in Peru.
That's 28 years. That is funny as fuck, dude.
But... throughout the years, Natalie's family continued to search and gather more information. On January 12, 2012, Natalie Holloway was officially declared deceased. And from there, the case went absolutely cold. Like, everyone thought, you know, like, hey, Jerron's not coming here until the end of the 28 years. Then, on May 10th, 2023... Peru made a surprise announcement that they had agreed to a temporary request of surrender of Jerron to the U.S. so he could face trial.
Ooh, good.
On June 9th, 2023, Jerron pled not guilty to extortion and wire fraud charges. However, on October 18th, Jerron Vandersloot confessed to killing Natalie Holloway as part of a plea deal.
No shit. Wait, what kind of plea deal did they offer him that he just admitted to murder? Is he dumb?
Yeah. So, according to Jerron's confession, Natalie, Jerron, DePeek, and Satish left Carlos and Charlie's around 1:30 a.m., he described that Natalie wanted to go back to the hotel room, but Jerron actually asked Deepak to drop the two off at a beach near the hotel.
That sounds right.
They laid down on the beach and started kissing, and Jerron began touching her. However, Natalie told him no. Jerron, because he's a horrible human being, kept touching her anyway, and eventually Natalie kneed him in the crotch, which upset him. He got up and he kicked her, quote, extremely hard in the face, end quote, which knocked Natalie unconscious, and Jerron, realizing that he hurt Natalie, spotted a cinder block nearby.
Is he stupid?
He, quote, I took this and, smash her head in it with complete, or smash her head in with it completely. God, he even talks like an idiot. Even though it's dark, I could see her faces collapsed in. Afterwards, I didn't know what to do, you know. I'm scared. I decide to take her,
you know,
and put her in the ocean. So I grab her and half pull her and half walk her into the ocean. I walk about up to my knees and I push her off into the sea. And after that, I get out and walk home, end quote.
If that's the case, how did she not, how was she not found? Like,
yeah, usually, yeah.
Wouldn't the current have just washed her up on shore somewhere?
Yeah, usually that's what happens. But I don't know, maybe she got like one of those riptides that got taken out and she just like, her body just never... washed up or anyone Man. Found.
Too bad it didn't take him at the same time.
Right? Judge Anna Manisco, who was the judge overseeing Jerron's extortion case, said, quote, I have considered your confession to the brutal murder of Natalie Holloway. You have brutally murdered in separate incidents, years apart, two beautiful women who refused your sexual advances, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
She sentenced Duran to 20 years in prison for the extortion and wire fraud charges in a term that runs concurrently with his Peruvian mm-hmm. sentence.
Yeah, get fucked.
Yep. That means that he probably will never serve time in the U.S. for the murder of Natalie, as of now, at least.
He's never getting out.
Yeah. Beth recently stated in an interview that upon reading and listening to what actually happened to Natalie, she stated, quote, "It's just blistering to your soul and hurts so deeply." She said that she recognized her feisty daughter in Geron's description of her kneeing him. Quote, mm-hmm. "Yes, I said, that's her. She fought like hell. I think she fought like hell with her killer. She was killed just by standing her ground. I was so proud of her."
That's sweet.
And that is the story of the murder of Natalie Holloway.
Damn. I'm glad that there's closure on that case now, though.
But it also, like, makes me really mad because, like, Stephanie could have been saved if the police just would have listened to Beth in the first place yeah. and taken her investigation, well, and taken the investigation serious.
Yeah. But, like, there's no telling how many other times he's done this or, like, done other things to women because...
That hotel employee said he's a predator. So I would assume...
So why is he still allowed there? Kick his ass out.
Yep. And I assume that he's done, like... He's forced women to do things that they don't want to do. And I think that's a safe assumption.
Yep. Can already call that fact, basically. But the way that he described, like, collapsing her face in...
It's horrible. And that's... I left out some of the details in the confession, because you can read his whole confession online, and it's pretty... It's brutal. I don't recommend. Yeah, I don't recommend.
Yeah, I'm good. No. And, like, if someone can just sit there and say things like that and then just not even be fazed, like...
And someone who can do that and then just be like, yep, I walked out of the ocean and I went home.
You have disassociated so completely.
Yes.
That's scary. That's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. But that is our case for this week.
Thank you, kitten.
Oh, is he talking?
Do you have something else? Yeah. Do you have something else
to say? He said, no more of the sad shit, but I am sorry. Oh,
okay.
Our podcast is called Horse for Whore.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be back in 2 weeks for another story. Bye.
Thanks for coming back. Bye.